you know, for med students, graduating med students, which is happening like right now, this is an optimal time if you can graduate and certify your income right now on an income-driven repayment plan, because you can use last year's tax return, where presumably, unless you're a real overachiever, you probably earned not that much money last year. If it was less than 18K, then your payments are going to be zero on an income-driven plan.
Welcome, Student Loan Planner community. Today, I've got a real treat for you. We have all of the Justice League assembled in one place. I'm joking, of course, because we have all of our Student Loan Planner consultants on the podcast today. So what's going on, guys?
What's up, Travis? Great to be here.
Hey, Travis.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Woo. So we got Justin, Rob, and Lauren, and we're going to talk today about something that's pretty interesting to me. We're going to talk about shady loan strategies and legit loan strategies, and we're going to debate it. And then we're also going to go into a couple examples of just like client situations we've seen in the past couple weeks, because I know that we've gotten a lot of feedback from you that you would love to hear more of the consultants, and not just me and Student Loan Planner at this point is actually more of the three other people in this call than me. So let's just jump right into it. The first strategy I want to debate is, I get this one all the time. I don't know about you guys, but I can't access my spouse's income information. What do y'all think about that?
I think this one's funny because I don't know what you guys hear, but I regularly hear servicers actually advising people to check that box. They say, listen, do revise pay as you earn. Check this box. If you do that, your payments are going to be way less. And I tell them, well, I think what's happening is that the servicer is kind of telling you to commit fraud. And that this box is intended for if you're legally separated or in some kind of domestic abuse situation, and you're actually telling the truth when you check the box that says there is no way for me to reasonably access my spouse's financial information.
People get pretty upset too, because they're like, how could the servicer be wrong? And one of the things I often have to explain is this idea that the people on the other end of the phone are frequently wrong, and they're not trained in any, you know, financial expertise or any area beyond the actual training they get, and, you know, are frequently just reading from a screen. So that debate back and forth with the client of whether I'm right or the person on the telephone was right is one of the things we come up against too.
Yeah. And I just add to that, just saying that a lot of times people file their tax returns jointly, and then they say that they can't access their spouse's income. Well, if you're looking at the tax form, you have to sign it. And if you sign it, then you're sort of acknowledging that you can access the information, that you've actually seen the information in the tax return. So it's
busted.
Right.
It's funny too, because a lot of the people that I see comment about it, they're like, well, this is wrong. They should not be able to force me to share my spouse's information when I don't want to. And I'm like, well, dude, I don't want to pay like high taxes. I wish Social Security was optional instead of mandatory so I could go invest the money instead. But like, that's not an option, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I just feel bad for a lot of the borrowers out there because they're getting all this misinformation, kind of to your point, Lauren. Sometimes it's not even the person who has a student debt, it's not even their fault. They've just been advised wrongly by someone that they trust or someone that they should be able to trust. And then it puts them in a bad position.
That's right. And a lot of borrowers, I think, they're willing to pay what they owe in many cases. And they're trying to figure out the best strategy, and they can't objectively know the best strategy. It's kind of similar to taxes in some way, where it can be very complicated very quickly. And if you were to say, listen, here's the number you owe, people generally, they want to pay what they owe, to the extent that they possibly can. But when it gets so complicated with what do I even owe? What's the right way to do this? Where do I get good information? Because borrowers can't find the right answer to that question, they're often hamstrung and don't know how to proceed.
So I think that there's a couple better options than saying that you can't access your spouse's information, right? So you can do pay as you earn or IBR, and you can file separately and legally exclude your spouse's income information in terms of the payment calculation. And then the only scenario that I can think of where you could possibly have it benefit you in any way is if you're doing the revised pay as you earn program and filing separately, because then maybe you have a legal argument that, well, I don't know my spouse's income information because we filed taxes separately. But that was an even better scenario there. It's just don't get legally married. We have a lot of people that, you know, I don't know if y'all have had as bad situations happen to you as me. I had a couple cases where people actually literally decided to strategically get divorced during the consult. So that is a real risk that we have to disclose of getting a plan from Student Loan Planner is ultra rational partners might be like, well, okay, we'll just like do the $300 divorce option. Now we save $5,000 a year. And as soon as they did that, I was like, no, please don't. Let me just run the numbers, make sure it covered my bases. If you're going to do that, I want to make sure it's really freaking accurate.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You haven't had anything like that happen, right?
Well, I had one of those last week, actually. It was a couple, and one of them had massive student loans. The other one didn't. And they were, at the end, they're like, maybe we should just get divorced. And I said, well, is that something you've discussed? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, you know, that's totally your call. You know, it just depends on if the cost is worth it to you. You know, if you're going to save $5,000 a year and that's worth it to be divorced, you know, just make sure. If anyone ever brings that up, I usually advise against it. But I just say, hey, if you are going to do that, you know, I don't recommend you do that, but just make sure you're talking with a high quality estate attorney who can actually set up your stuff legally as if you are together, especially if there are kids involved. Because in this case, there were two kids involved. The last thing you want is the courts to decide who takes care of the kids and who handles the money because you want to save $5,000 a year in your student loans. So working with an estate attorney before coming to that conclusion is probably a must.
I just have to say, I'm really lucky that we paid off our student loan debt, because if some consultant told Christine that she could dump me for, you know, $5,000 a year savings, you know, I'd be in big trouble. But moving on, shady strategy number two, starting your own 501c3 to get public service loan forgiveness. So I'm going to go and I'm going to start my own, you know, nonprofit organization. And I'm going to be CEO of it, and I'm going to have my board, you know, hold minutes and everything. And I'm going to get all my loans forgiven tax free. What do y'all think about this one?
Oh boy, that's super risky. I mean, I had one call where someone was thinking about it, or they maybe, oh, actually they said that their friends were doing that kind of a thing. And I said, you know, it's one thing to commit fraud on your student loans. It's another thing to have a problem with the IRS. The IRS is a totally different ball of wax. They will track you down, and you could have severe penalties beyond just, you know, giving up loan forgiveness if it's just trying to get a benefit to federal loan payment.
Justin, Lauren, what do you think?
I echo Rob's sentiment in the sense that it's just a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of hoops to jump through, and you're really trying to work the system whenever you do it. And I mean, at the end of the day, setting up a 501c3 is really about creating something that's going to make America better. So the intent is the biggest deal here. Is I'm doing something that's going to benefit me, when the intent of a 501c3 is to benefit others, benefit the community, to continue to improve society as a whole. And so I think we should be continuing to focus on that and continue to spread love and abundance and, you know, these ideas that I own my student loan debt and I need to make the best strategy on my debt, but I'm not going to make the strategy based on something that is not of good intent.
Yeah. And I always just encourage people, whether it's this issue or a similar, act in such a way that you're going to be able to sleep at night. Because at the end of the day, life is not about financial optimization. It's about being the kind of person that you're going to be happy with and proud of. And if you're going to start a 501c3 and, you know, function legally, actually in that organization to be able to promote some kind of social change or whatever, then great. And do it. And you might have to argue to the IRS that it's a legal strategy. But if you're sleeping well at night and you have the proof that you've done what you've done and it seems to be all buttoned up, then great, good for you. But as a workaround strategy to try to, you know, cheat on your loans, do you really want to be that kind of person? I hope not.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem too is just that right now it's kind of like the Wild West out there, where all these programs are so new and there's so little people having success at this point. You know, that's going to change over the next couple of years as more people have direct loans eligible for forgiveness. But people don't really know if there's a downside or not. Once the government finds out or the IRS finds out about these strategies, there's going to be some crackdown, but we haven't seen any yet because, you know, no one's really gotten to that point where they're really taking advantage of the rules that way. Totally echo what Lauren said. You know, if you want to make the world a better place and that is the intent and it's a legitimate strategy, then by all means, we'd love to have more do-gooders in the country, but it's just something to proceed with caution. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, and that uncertainty scares me. Especially when we're dealing with IRS issues.
Sure, but crackdown implies that they know what the heck's going on in the first place.
That's true. I mean, there could be that there's going to be so many people using so many different strategies that they might not be able to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think when they start having the negative headlines, when PSLF starts happening en masse for lots of physicians that are making six-figure incomes, I think that it would be foolish not to expect very, very negative headlines. And that's something that's going to happen. And you just have to be comfortable just having that kind of headline happen and just not reacting from it. Mm-hmm. Because I think that a lot of people are not really that aware of the program. Like, yeah, like the niche sites and like the fifth page of the Wall Street Journal, you know, has done a lot of topics about how PSLF is going to people with an average loan balance of 90,000 when the average balance overall is 30. So it's clearly something that's helping people with more than average debt. But I think that the big thing is just you just can't react. But let's keep moving with some of these shady strategies. What are some other ones that maybe I didn't think about? Put your criminal hat on and think of the sketchiest thing you can think about. Is there anything real bad that we haven't talked about?
I had a case the other day, Travis, and I'd be interested to hear what you think about this. I had two spouses, one of whom was a borrower. It was the husband that had, call it $220K of loans, and the wife had no loans. They both worked for the same business that the husband owned and operated, and he had $100K of income of AGI, and she had 50. And so in this situation, all the loans are his. You know, if they did some sort of married filing separately strategy, they might be able to exclude her income. And so because they're business owners, they hypothesized, well, maybe we can control who makes how much. And they said, well, maybe the wife sort of does the admin and the husband is the CEO, but maybe the wife should be making 125 and the husband should make 25. And then they should do married filing separately. And he can make income adjusted payments on the $25,000. I told him, listen, I'm not an accountant, a forensic accountant for the IRS, but this doesn't pass the smell test. So I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I'm not going to sit here and say that that's a good idea.
Just to try to get me to commit tax fraud in a recorded line, you know? I mean, thanks, Justin. But in all seriousness, I think that, I mean, honestly, like that kind of thing could be legitimate potentially. I mean, you have to consult with your CPA. We got to say that. They're the ones that understand the tax code, that there's the ones that I would go to and turn to if this is a legitimate thing. But the IRS sets very wide latitude for, you know, especially for small business owners that are a couple that are kind of running it together to figure out what's fair and reasonable compensation. And if you can make an argument that somebody's contribution to the business is really substantial and they could deserve to get paid X, I think that that's something that probably has a pretty good chance of flying, to be quite honest, you know, compared to some of the most aggressive strategies that we've seen, like saying you can't access your spouse's income when it's literally on the joint return that you had to sign that, you know, you filed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, along those same lines, I bumped into quite a few people who are interested in using their pay stub to certify their income. So maybe have like a six-figure income and want to say, oh, I'm only paying myself $40,000 a year, and their pay stub represents that. And so that's how they're using to get a really low student loan payment, even though that total income is on their tax return.
Yeah, I don't think that's okay to just use pay stubs if there's other income on the return. What do y'all think?
Well, in addition, my understanding is with the pay stubs, you also have to have a signed affidavit that says this pay stub, I hereby solemnly swear, is a fair representation of my total earnings. Is that right?
If they request it. I had a consult, this was probably 3 weeks ago, where they had significant real estate income that was basically half of their total AGI, would have been half of their AGI based upon the conversation, but they were only providing their pay stubs instead of their tax return. Again, the loan servicer recommended they do it. And they didn't require that affidavit letter. Other things I've seen are that someone gets massive stock compensation. You know, they work on the Pacific Coast for a tech company. They get massive stock compensation is not included in their pay stub. So that's all, you know, I don't really know. I mean, if the loan servicer is requesting it, it's hard to know, you know, how to tell what to tell someone in that instance.
And the rules aren't clear.
Right.
Well, I would play a little bit of devil's advocate here. I think the rules are super clear that you're supposed to reflect your entire taxable income. So right. If somebody is giving a pay stub and the loan servicer, like the loan servicer is not the arbiter, right? Like
right.
the loan servicer, like somebody told you to do something in a recorded line at Fed Loan, that's like a $12 an hour person that's going to be there for like 6 months and they're going to take a different job making $15 an hour as a associate at Walmart. I don't want to be mean or anything, but that's just the reality of what's kind of going on. The quality of the advice that you're getting is very, very low. So just because somebody says that you could do that, it doesn't really mean anything. Like the loan servicer, you can't trust them. So the way that the rules are written, you have to tell your loan servicer about all of the taxable income. If they said use your pay stubs and you gave them tax return information and pay stub information, the only time you can really use pay stubs is if you're saying that your taxable income is not an accurate reflection of your current income or your taxable income, which you can make a really good argument that the current pay stub is now the accurate reflection of your income. Like, for example, those stock options, maybe you do 6 months of payments on something like revised pay as you earn, but then you're like, well, that's already happened. It's in the past. Now my income's different. So I'm going to recertify and I'm going to use my pay stubs to recertify. Like, I could see that being legit. But, you know, you just got to be conservative.
I've had a couple where I've got an attorney who works at a salary, and then maybe at the end of the year, they get some kind of profit share or performance bonus. That's a big number. So say they make 150 is their salary, and then they could have a 70K bonus that they get every December. But it's a discretionary bonus at the discretion of the employer. So if it's February and I'm recertifying, is this attorney, should they be certifying based on a pay stub, which shows their salary, or should they incorporate that bonus that's a discretionary bonus at the will of their employer that may or may not hit at the end of the year, but did hit 2 months ago?
Cayman Islands, that's my answer. Yeah, just put it all there, then nobody sees anything, right? No, just kidding. Just kidding, IRS agents that listen to the podcast.
So I guess what I'm getting at is this is one of those areas, like, I guess it's not clear. It's not explicit based on the rules. Would you say, Travis? Or Rob? Or Lauren?
Yeah. Is it based upon what they have made or what they are going to make? So if there's any uncertainty, it's sort of like someone who, let's just say someone has like a seven-figure salary and they just started in the job for a week. Do they really have $1 million salary? You know, because they just started making that income. Or do we take their prior year income, which is the more accurate reflection of what's actually happening for student loan recertifying of income purposes? You know, me, I always err on the side of like tax return is the most official way to document that. But, you know, there are exceptions, obviously.
Here's kind of the way that I look at it. You can be super aggressive changing plans if you don't mind messing around with things. So you can always apply for a forbearance. And if your loan servicer grants you a forbearance, then you can put off payments for 12 months. And then you can always use your tax returns to certify your income. So let's say you got that big jump in your income and you decide, well, I don't really want to pay $4,000 a month for 12 months. You're legally allowed to request a forbearance. If the loan servicer grants you one, then you basically put your, you capitalize your interest, obviously, but you put off your payments for 12 months, and then you can start repayment 12 months later, potentially using a more attractive tax return. Another way that you could manage this would be if you're using consolidation loans, if you already have consolidation loans, you can always sign up for the 30-year consolidation standard repayment plan. So you could switch off of income-driven repayment like Repayee onto something that is like a 30-year type plan. And obviously those payments don't count towards forgiveness. But what you might have done is avoiding having to pay 10% of what could be a super high but super temporary income. So I think that there's tons of strategies that you can use that are legitimate to avoid making payments on that temporary boost of your income.
I had a case similar to that fairly recently where a young lady had 2 years of PSLF qualified payments and needed to get some sort of specific training at a 1.5 year program where at a for-profit organization. So she decided to do the forbearance for the 1.5 years, knowing that she's going back to PSLF and that she's definitely committed to taking that route because, like you said, the income was going to jump up quite a bit over that time period and it wasn't going to be PSLF qualifying payments.
It's a great strategy. I think that's super smart. I think you're supposed to take advantage of all the rules within the law, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that saved them a lot of money, probably.
We like talking about legit strategies, so we're going to transition into that next. And anybody else have anything last they want to say about the shady stuff?
Maybe to just quickly touch on shady companies. I know that's something we've talked a lot about probably already on this podcast, but make sure that you understand who you're getting advice from and what their incentives are and what their the other financial relationships which they may have. And, you know, even a quick Google search, if the first couple hits on Google come up with like scam alert with this company that you're paying $20 a month to quote unquote service your loans or to get some advice from, just make sure that you do a little bit of research, make sure that you can find some sort of evidence that who you're doing business with over the phone or online is a valid company who's going to point you in the right direction.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Justin. And I think it's important too to always look at like kind of studentaid.gov or something that's an official site before deciding whether something sounds like it's the right thing or the wrong thing. Because sometimes people are getting information from all over the place. And what I hear frequently is, you know, someone pays $700 or $800 to get their loans consolidated. And that's something you can do for free on your own. There's instructions on for what to do. There's no service that's required to consolidate your loans. And then, like you said, from a shady perspective, some people use the word consolidation and refinancing interchangeably. And so they tell you they're going to help you consolidate your loans. They charge you for that. And they've actually refinanced your loans, which is not the exact same thing.
Very good point, Lauren.
Yeah. You know, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/reviews. that has a link to some of our reviews. It also has a link to our reviews. We keep most of all of our reviews on our Facebook page. So if you go to studentloanplanner.com/reviews and then just click the link to the Facebook page, you can read like 140 or something reviews that we have for our service. I think Rob is the most complimented of the four of us. I don't know. I think Rob just has like that super soothing voice that just puts people totally at ease. Like, I think Rob could probably convince somebody to do anything with their finances. Like, I don't know. I always feel I feel like a Baptist preacher, you know, where I'm telling them like how their finances are so terrible they have to repent, you know. And Rob's just like this super relaxing dude. I don't know, Rob, do you think that's accurate?
Well, no, I think I just put it at the end of every recap email that I send to clients. So there's more of an opportunity for people to post it. And I just use the template that we all use. And, you know, we talk about all these strategies. So I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. I'm probably just more often doing that. But I think it's important, though. I mean, kind of to that point, the plan is one thing, but I think just getting peace of mind and having clarity and showing people how much they're going to save is really huge. And I try to help people understand that these changes are going to change their lives and help, you know, kind of help them see the bigger picture aside from just student loans. You know, so I don't know. I appreciate you saying that.
Justin, Lauren, was that mean?
Good job, Rob.
Was that accurate?
No.
No.
I mean, that sounds absolutely right. And Rob deserves every accolade that he receives. Lauren?
He does. It's like you're laying on the couch getting therapy, like when you're listening to him. You're like, oh, my day is just so much. Like, you're right. That makes so much sense, Rob. Like, okay, I'm going to go do that immediately.
And I think my kids would disagree with you.
For you 200 to 400K borrowers out there, you know, you can sit on the metaphorical counseling couch and get your loans fixed with the Rob Berman Show.
if you're at like 195, you should probably just let some more interest accrue so you can jump up into Rob's category and then do business with Rob.
Or me, right? Like, you know, if you just put it in forbearance for a couple decades and you know, if that's possible. So, you know, I mean, like, it's interesting, like the different people have different motivations, right? It's like my goal with Student Loan Planner was to bring folks like you on the team that were super qualified. Everybody's got CFP or CFA designation. I think Rob's got both, you know, just to heap more praise on him. But, you know, I think that that's really important to me. Like, I didn't want people doing plans for our team that weren't like the top 1% of folks out there in terms of just how much they care about clients, how smart they are with money in general, how experienced they are. So lucky to have you all on the team. I'm lucky that I've had a very good grounding, like that I haven't gotten too greedy, knock on wood, right? Because there's definitely a lot of companies out there that their goal is like, bam, let's make $10 million as fast as I can, move it all to the Cayman Islands, you know, so nobody can come after it. And the student loan thing is going to make me rich. Like, I think that that's probably 80 to 90% of what drives the student loan consolidation scam stuff. Like, there was a guy that got arrested in the San Francisco airport. Body was stuffed full of like cash and right before like they froze all of his assets, I think he transferred out like a six-figure sum or something, like right before they froze everything. And they, supposedly, according to the stuff I read on the news, this person has accounts in like Luxembourg and like all over the place. So I don't know, but
you don't have an account in Luxembourg?
I do not. I have visited Liechtenstein though. Random kind of quote of the day: when I was doing my sabbatical, my early retirement phase after I was a bond trader, I decided that how cool would it be if I walked across an entire country as a bucket list thing. So I chose Liechtenstein, which is like next to Vienna and Switzerland.
The smallest country in the world.
Yeah. And it took me, you know, it only took me like a couple hours. And then I took the public bus back. And I have to say, like, you think of like a public bus, this was like the Mercedes limousine of like public buses, dude. Like, I got on and like I paid, but like I'm sitting on there and like everybody in the bus looks like they're a multimillionaire. And I'm just, you know, I look like I'm a American, like homeless person, you know, sitting on the bus. Man, that was fascinating. Apparently, like I don't want to get too detoured. The country of Liechtenstein has billions and billions of dollars like hidden away and stashed in like artwork and all these like secret trusts. I mean, it's really interesting. If you do want to be a terrible person and hide away a bunch of money and flee to like a third world country, you know, you can definitely do that. But that's not what we do. We're trying to make you comfortable from a legitimate standpoint. So talking about legitimate strategies for student loans, so what do y'all think about using last year's tax returns to certify income? You know, legit, you know, you got to report the higher income if it's changed. You know, what are y'all's thoughts about that?
I think it's totally legit. I mean, that's sort of the official way, right? When you recertify your income, if they're pulling adjusted gross income, to calculate what they call discretionary income to calculate student loan payments, the best place to find that is off the prior year tax return. That's like the most official way. And you're only required to recertify once a year, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. And, you know, for med students, graduating med students, which is happening like right now, because we're recording this at the middle of May. I don't know when this episode's going to air. This is an optimal time if you can graduate and certify your income right now on an income-driven repayment plan, because you can use last year's tax return, where presumably, unless you're a real overachiever, you probably earned not that much money last year. If it was less than 18K, then your payments are going to be zero on an income-driven plan. Whereas if you wait until the end of your grace period in November, you won't have that same ability to say that your income hasn't changed this year. So there's this window where you can certify that zero using last year's income, and it's something to pounce on if you can.
I think it's really important too to note that it's not just the strategy, but also what you do with the strategy. So now you have this really low payment. You're probably, like you said, just getting started because you've been a broke college student for a while. So this gives you an opportunity to build that emergency fund. This gives you an opportunity to create some real financial stability, understand your bills as you're going through the changes of moving and, you know, getting it settled into a new place. So it's not just a low student loan payment. It's a great opportunity to start setting yourself up by having that low payment, not having that to deal with in your budget, but getting your budget nailed down so that once it kicks in and it's ready to go, you're also ready to go. As it pertains to how that is going to affect you financially.
Yeah, I don't want to say that I've lost any sleep over this, but I do sometimes wonder, you know, it does ask, has your income significantly changed? And, you know, especially when you're like a fellow and you just became an attending and you're answering that question after you just became an attending physician or a full earning dentist or veterinarian, whatever it is. The way I kind of get comfortable with saying no to that question is just, have I earned the full year's worth of income yet? If my income has not significantly changed based off my tax return, then I always feel comfortable saying no and just giving them the tax return. You know, if you give them the tax return, the prior year tax return every single time, I find it very, very difficult how you could ever be accused of anything, because all you did was use the tax return that you submitted to the IRS, you know, assuming, of course, that that tax return is legitimate. So going into the next question, the breadwinner and the reverse breadwinner loophole. So maybe we should trademark that. I don't know. Maybe y'all could come up with a better loophole name than that, like something like way more exciting, right? But maybe tell our listeners what the breadwinner and the reverse breadwinner loophole even is.
Reverse breadwinner. That's kind of a funny phrase.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know. Like, we need something better. Like, you know, like lucky spouse rule or something. I don't know. Right.
I've been both. So, you know, I can be the acid test for whether it's appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know something about that as well.
So I did this thing with Christine, right, where she was talking about how, well, she's the breadwinner. So I decided, well, I'm going to contribute 1 cent more automatically every month to our joint bank account so that I can claim that I'm the breadwinner.
Well, that penny, you know, that penny makes a big difference. I'm sure that, you know, I would call you the breadwinner. That penny probably, you know, there's a lot you can do with that.
Hey, savings rate, right? It's the most important thing. But so, like, breadwinner loophole, basically you're in a community property state, you're filing taxes separately, you equalize your incomes to pay less on your student loans. Reverse breadwinner is kind of like when you're the lower income person and you do that filing separately thing, which helps with the tax penalties, but you're not actually able to use your tax returns anymore because that's going to mean a higher payment. So you have to use pay stubs. So I think that we did an episode, I want to say it was episode number 6, where we talked about the breadwinner loophole. If people are interested in that, if you live like in a West Coast state, or Wisconsin, randomly, is the other one that's community property.
Or Texas.
Well, Texas and Louisiana, right? So it's basically like, draw a line from Louisiana directly to Los Angeles, and every state that you hit is a community property state, and then go north. And I think like the only one that's not listed is like Oregon, right? So
skip Oregon and hit Washington and Wisconsin.
And Nevada.
Yeah. It's basically like the places that used to be possessions of Mexico. They operated off of Spanish civil law. And we decided to keep Spanish civil law. We took it over in the Mexican-American War. And then because of a bunch of weird student loan things, now the Mexican-American War impacts student loan rolls. Wow, that would be a fun blog post, right?
I did not know that.
How the Mexican-American War affects your student loan repayment. Okay, I think we just lost our entire listenership.
Yeah, we're still on the call though, so.
So another one I think that's legit is moving abroad. to pay $0 a month. So I listened to this Freakonomics podcast that recently talked about student loans, and they actually said that in 2016, Australia closed this loophole because they gave everyone free tuition, and then you paid it back kind of in higher taxes. But a lot of Australians were leaving and just moving abroad and paying nothing, and they just closed this rule in 2016. But good news for all of our American listeners, this loophole still exists. So you can go to any other country in the world and earn below $100,000 of income and pay nothing on your loans. Brain Trust, what do we think of this one?
I'm a big fan. I mean, so here's the thing is you don't want to let the tail wag the dog. So you don't want to say, oh my gosh, I owe so much money, I'm going to move to some far-flung place where I don't know anything or anyone just to try to get out of paying loans. I mean, that's, I'm not sure that that's the best strategy. But I talked to somebody the other day who was living in London. They were 24. They had just graduated. They were on an income-driven plan. They weren't PSLF eligible. So they weren't, you know, moving towards the 10-year forgiveness, but they were moving towards a 20-year, well, it was 25, I guess, for revised pay as you earn, a longer-term forgiveness plan, and they were paying zero. So it's kind of a little bit of a kick the can move, but it can make a lot of sense, especially if you're kind of living life, you know, in like 6 to 12 month chunks.
Yeah, I've actually had a few of these consults over the last month. I mean, the first question I ask is, well, how much are you making in the States? Would you be making in the States, and how much would you be making abroad? Because at the end of the day, I mean, cost of living, depending on what country you move to, if you're living in London, obviously cost of living is more expensive. But if you're moving to like Costa Rica or something, at the end of the day, you know, if you want to build wealth, you still have to earn enough to support your family. And the tax bomb is still going to be owed, right? Because that's not considered earned income. So you still have to like save aggressively for the tax bomb, which will be higher if you do that. You won't have any payments, but the loans are not going away. They're still going to be there. You don't want to let the tail wag the dog, just like you said, Jason. But it's important to see, you know, look at the total income and savings and net worth picture and projections of their financial future along with the student loan payment.
Yeah, but Jason, I think you meant Justin.
Oh, sorry.
I was going to let it slide.
Jason, if there's a Jason listening that you think you're really qualified in giving student loan planning, we would love to add you onto the team. I'm just pulling your chain, Rob.
No. Next hire is going to be another girl. I need some woman firepower back here with me.
No question. You're pulling it for a lot of people.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Hopefully we can keep crushing it with this podcast and get more consults and hire another person at the team. So that'd be cool. That might actually happen in probably like 6 months or so. It's probably my guess. So for the last bit of this, are there any other strategies that you think that we have missed, like some kind of fun things that people should know about, just topics that you think are really relevant for our listeners to know?
Well, before we switch to last strategies, I just wanted to say one last thing about the FEIE, I guess it is technically, rule. I had a consult a couple of weeks ago where a mature woman had managed to not pay her student loans for quite a while. We're talking, you know, something over 20 years, and was just getting ready to try to figure out her plan for the first time, and was also living abroad, making around 25K a year. So well under that 100K, which would result in a zero payment for her. So after we got to the bottom of everything, we figured out that she would be starting fresh from the very beginning, getting on a loan repayment strategy because she was getting ready to retire. She already had minimal income and was getting ready to retire, so that she would never get to a point where she'd have a payment. So then you have to worry about the tax bomb. Well, if she's 65 now, she'd be 90 after the 25 years passed, which she was pretty sure she wouldn't be alive. And we know federal loans are forgiven if you pass away. So we talked about strategies for, you know, her attempting to save for the tax bomb. But then we also talked about the insolvency rule. And at the time that they were getting ready to be forgiven, that being a plausible option for her.
That is a fascinating point. I'm glad you brought that up. So we call this the die with the debt strategy. And it sounds super depressing. That sounds like, you know, throw yourself off a cliff because you have student loan strategy or something. That's like not a very smart thing. But that's actually one of the smartest things you can possibly do if you are in that situation. Because like, obviously, you know, if you could be in debt or not be in debt, being not in debt, it's great. But if you are, then go ahead and get a $0 payment or super low payment that's primarily based on your Social Security income where it's almost nothing. And then, you know, if you do make it to 90, hey, you know what? We've got some amazing lawyers that are friends of ours that would love to file a disability declaration to get your loans discharged because of disability if you're not even able to use the insolvency rule. The good news is you might legitimately not know who you are, and Navient would have a really hard time collecting your loan if you didn't know. Sorry, this is a really terrible joke, but if you didn't know who you were, it might be hard to collect, right? Like,
if you get to year 24 and you still have your wits about you, you know, and you're 89 years old, you could always consolidate again, wipe away that credit towards a loan repayment, and start the 25 years at when you're in 89. Why not do that?
Exactly. And some of y'all are financial planners and you know, have a broader focus on clients' lives. And this is an amazing opportunity, really, if you have student debt and you're over 50. We've written a lot about this in the blog. The idea is that, you know, you can, if you have tons of debt, you can claim Social Security at 70 instead of the vast majority of people claim it. I think 40% of people claim it at 62. Isn't that nuts? You know, that like 40% of people give themselves a, you know, way, way lower benefit for the rest of their lives. And only 2% of people wait until 70. I think I'm not sure if that's the stat, but I heard that recently. And that just blows my mind, because like 70% or you're 70 years old, if you wait till that point, you get a much higher benefit with Social Security for the rest of your life. So a lot of people out there could retire in their 60s and spend everything they've got and then do Social Security and live a pretty good life. And then when you can't take care of yourself anymore, Medicaid actually covers nursing home bills for the middle class in America. That's how the vast majority of people pay for their Medicaid, is through the government. So, but you know, we're getting into really kind of weird stuff, right? You know, maybe I'll just get arrested someday, y'all, because I say that we save people projected like $100 billion, which I believe that we have. But the problem is the vast majority of that expense has come at the expense of Uncle Sam. So, you know, maybe I need to be careful. Hopefully those IRS agents aren't listening to the podcast, right?
Well, but you know what, though? This is kind of the benefit of the business that you built up, is because, I mean, what are we're up to, what, over $500 million of loans advised and over like 2,000 consults. So I don't know anyone who has that kind of experience doing one-on-one consults. I mean, so we've seen pretty much everything, and we talk regularly too, right? The four of us, so we can compare notes and talk through this stuff. This is sort of like a peek into our, you know, our consultant meeting. But, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that can be done. And people who are feeling like their loan situation is hopeless, or that they don't really know how they're going to make it through, I mean, chances are, between the four of us, we've seen a situation that we can actually have a legitimate strategy, you know, a legit loan strategy that can actually help. Even something as wacky as what we're talking about, the die with the debt rule, you know, it's just, or the reverse breadwinner loophole. I mean, no one else has seen this stuff. So we got a lot of expertise over here, thanks to you and the team you built.
Well, thank you so much, listeners. And I will say this, if you would rather live with your debt instead of die with your debt, this is an amazing team to work with. So just check out studentloanplanner.com/help to work with any one of these amazing people.
But mostly Rob.
Well, yeah, Rob, and then Justin and Lauren, and then Travis, you know, if you want the third tier option, right?
Well, see, I think what you guys are forgetting, I know you're wrapping up, but what you guys are forgetting is that I'm like the senior member, like I'm almost 40 and I got three kids. And so I think that's probably why you guys are seeing all this stuff, and why, you know, I have both the CFP and the CFA. I'm just older than all you guys.
The fastest growing segment of student loan borrowers is over 60. So we needed somebody on the team that could relate to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I'm that guy.
So on that note, we'll cut it. Thanks for listening to today's show. You can email us your comments at podcast@studentloanplanner.com. You can also find show notes at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, schedule one today with one of our team members at studentloanplanner.com/book. Or if you want to learn more, visit /help. If you like the podcast, please share it with someone who owes more student loan debt than you do. Keep calm and build wealth, and have a great week.